Welcome back to the Deep Dive. You've brought us, well, a monumental challenge today, diving headfirst into the historical deep end with Thomas Piketty's really comprehensive work, Capital and Ideology. And our mission here is to try and cut through the sheer scale of this source material.
Mm-hmm.
We want to distill Piketty's core and, I think, quite paradigm-shifting argument.
Yeah, it really is.
He basically argues that the economic inequality we see today isn't some, you know, unfortunate natural byproduct of technology or ironclad market laws.
Right, not inevitable.
No, instead, he says it's the direct demonstrable result of specific, deliberate political and ideological choices that societies make.
Exactly. And I think that's the hook, really. This is a book about the stories we tell ourselves to justify things. Yeah. We're going to dissect what Piketty calls these historical inequality regimes.
Okay.
These are the complex, often kind of hidden narratives societies construct to justify massive disparities in wealth and power.
So the stories make the inequality seem okay or normal.
Precisely. And by laying bare how these stories change over time, this historical contingency, he fundamentally challenges that comforting idea that today's wealth concentration is somehow natural or, you know, necessary. It puts agency back in the picture. It's about human choices, institutional design.
Okay, let's unpack that central thesis then, because it does require a bit of a shift in perspective, doesn't it? If inequality isn't purely economic or technological, why is it so entrenched? What does he mean when he insists it is ideological and political?
Well, it means inequality can't just survive on its own economic logic. To keep a huge gap between the rich and the poor going for centuries, the system needs people to believe it's fair, or at least unavoidable.
Right.
So societies create these inequality regimes, which are kind of two-layered. The first layer is the obvious stuff. The legal framework, the tax laws, property rights, inheritance rules.
The mechanics of the system.
Exactly. But the second, and maybe more crucial layer, is the powerful ideological narrative. That's the story that convinces people rich and poor that the current structure, no matter how unequal it looks, is actually legitimate. Maybe it's meritocratic, maybe it's divinely ordered, maybe it's just the way things are.
And we can actually trace this through history using his models. Let's maybe start with the pre-modern example, what he calls the ternary societies.
Right. Good place to start. Think medieval Europe, for instance. That society was pretty rigidly organized around, well, birthright, divided into three main orders: the clergy, the nobility, and then everyone else, the workers.
The three estates.
Yeah, and the ideology justifying this was often religious, you know, the idea of a divine, natural social order. If you were born a peasant, well, that was God's plan for you. You're meant to serve. It was an inequality based on fixed status, largely unchangeable.
But then the Enlightenment came along, shook things up. The revolutions of the 18th century, did they bring equality? Piketty seems to say, no, not really. They just swapped one ideology for another. Enter the proprietarian societies.
Yeah. Exactly right. And this is a super important distinction that I think often gets glossed over. If the ternary society was defined by birthright and status, the proprietarian society, born really in the 19th century, was defined by a new, almost, you could say, sacred belief in absolute unfettered private property rights.
Sacred. That's strong.
Well, the state's main job became the rigid protection of whatever you owned, period. Regardless of the social cost, regardless of how you got that wealth, this really radical approach to ownership led directly to extreme wealth concentration across Europe and the U.S. And it was justified simply by the absolute right of the owner, full stop.
What's really striking here is how he uses the most, well, brutal historical examples to show that these property rights aren't natural at all. They're totally contingent. Take his analysis of slave and colonial societies.
Yeah, those examples really expose the ideological limits of that proprietarian framework. They show just how easily property rights can be weaponized when combined with a powerful ideology.
How so?
Piketty found some pretty harrowing data. In the U.S. South, before the Civil War, the market value of enslaved people treated purely as property often exceeded the total combined value of all agricultural land and industrial capital put together.
Wow. More valuable than all the land and factories.
Exactly. It was an economic system built entirely on a radical racist ideology that literally defined human beings as property. It's maybe the starkest proof that property is whatever the legal and political system says it is. It's not based on some immutable moral or natural law.
That historical contingency, though, that's also the key to hope, isn't it? If property is a political construct, it means it can be politically changed.
Precisely.
Which leads us straight into the 20th century and that dramatic decline in inequality between, say, 1913 and 1980. He calls this the Great Compression. And you're saying that change wasn't driven by the market?
No, not at all. It was a direct result of deliberate political choices. Think about it. The huge shocks of the world wars, various revolutions, the Great Depression, these events completely destabilized and, frankly, delegitimized that old 19th century proprietarian order. People lost faith in it.
So politicians had to act.
They had to rebuild, yeah. And crucially, they built new structures specifically designed to constrain capital, not just protect it.
And the tools they used, they sound incredibly radical compared to today. You mentioned highly progressive income and inheritance taxes.
Oh, absolutely. We're talking about institutional changes that fundamentally altered who controlled capital flows. Piketty really emphasizes this. In the U.S. and the U.K. during this period, top marginal income tax rates soared, sometimes reaching 80 or even 90%.
80 or 90%.
Yeah. And this wasn't just about raising money, though it did that too. It was what you might call constructive taxation. It severely limited the ability of massive fortunes to just keep accumulating, generation after generation, reinvesting exponentially.
And that funded the welfare state.
Exactly. That funding, combined with the social shifts after the wars, powered the modern welfare state and created what was arguably the most equal period in modern history. The Great Compression proves, I think, that when the political will exists, the economic structure can be completely rewired.
Okay, but if it was so successful, why did that social democratic consensus eventually collapse? Piketty seems to argue it had an inherent vulnerability. It relied too much on the nation-state framework.
That's what he points to as the Achilles heel, yeah?
Yeah.
Those national tax systems, the regulations, they were powerful within their borders. But as capital became much more mobile, starting really in the 1970s, and globalization took off.
It got easier to move money around.
Much easier. For the wealthy, for corporations, it became simpler to shift assets, use tax havens, basically play countries off against each other, and circumvent national constraints. The structure was geographically confined, you see, and global capital exploited that weakness.
I see. So the mechanism weakened, which raises the question, how did the ideological counter-revolution, what we often call neoliberalism, justify the return to extreme wealth concentration that we've seen since the 1980s?
Well, once the political mechanism was weakened, the ideology could shift back. They essentially replaced the post-war ideology of collective constraint and shared prosperity with narratives focused on individual destiny.
Like what?
Narratives about market efficiency being paramount, the absolute necessity of deregulation to spur growth, tax cuts for the wealthy creating jobs, and maybe most importantly, a massive overemphasis on meritocracy.
Meritocracy.
Yeah. The story changed again. It shifted from shared prosperity back towards this idea that your wealth, no matter how vast it becomes, is purely a reflection of your unique individual contribution, your talent, your hard work. Never mind inherited advantages or systemic factors.
And this brings us right up to the present day, the contemporary puzzle. The data is undeniable. Inequality since 1980 has skyrocketed. Wealth concentration at the very top, the top 1%, is nearing Gilded Age levels again.
It is.
But Piketty takes a really interesting turn here. He doesn't just look at the economics. He examines how this economic reversal has driven a kind of great political reversal as well.
This is, I think, one of the most critical and up-to-date insights in the book. Piketty argues that the political landscape itself isn't structured around the classic rich versus poor anymore. Not primarily, anyway.
How has it changed, then?
He argues that the major traditional left-wing parties, think Social Democrats or Labor or Democrats, have increasingly become dominated by the highly educated, credentialed elite, people with university degrees, often in cities. He provocatively labels this the Brahmin left.
The Brahmin left, okay. And the right.
While the traditional right continues, by and large, to represent the interests of the highly wealthy elite business owners, financiers, he calls this the merchant right.
So a conflict between two different elites.
That's the fascinating part. We end up with a system defined by a conflict between two different types of elites. The wealthy elite, focused on low taxes and deregulation, and the educated elite, often more focused on social and cultural issues, maybe environmental concerns.
And where does that leave everyone else?
Well, according to Piketty, both these elite groups are pretty far removed, culturally and economically, from the lower and middle income majority. This multi-elite political system has left many lower-income, less educated voters across all backgrounds feeling completely abandoned on core economic issues.
Which creates an opening.
Exactly. It creates the perfect vacuum for global populist nativist movements to exploit. They step in, often appealing to identity, politics, nation, religion, ethnicity, rather than focusing on economic redistribution, because the traditional parties seem to have vacated that space.
Wow. Okay, so that's the diagnosis. It's quite a picture. But what does this all mean for the future? Does Pickey leave us just with this description, or does he offer solutions? He talks about a blueprint for a new regime, right? Participatory socialism.
He does. He doesn't just diagnose, he prescribes. And his proposals are, shall we say, challenging. They're pretty radical because they're designed to break the concentrated power of accumulated capital by fundamentally restructuring property and power relations themselves.
So going beyond just tweaking income tax rates.
Way beyond. They really challenge the core tenets of that 19th century proprietarianism we talk about, the absolute sanctity of private property.
Okay, let's get concrete. What are these proposals? The first one is an aggressive return to wealth taxation you mentioned.
Absolutely. He suggests a highly progressive annual wealth tax, not just on inheritance, but on total wealth every year. And the rates could potentially climb really high, maybe even up to 90% for the world's largest fortunes.
90% annual wealth tax, is that feasible?
Well, the goal isn't necessarily to collect 90% from Bill Gates every year. It's more about enforcing a fundamental constraint on exponential wealth accumulation. It's designed to prevent the existence of these self-perpetuating, unchecked dynasties that gain ever more economic and political power.
So it's a limiting mechanism.
Right.
Okay. What's the second proposal? Something about starting opportunity, a universal capital endowment.
Yeah, think of it as trying to fundamentally level the starting line at least a bit. He proposes providing a substantial capital grant, a lump sum of money to every single citizen when they reach adulthood.
Like a nest egg from the state.
Sort of.
Yeah.
He throws out a figure like, say, 120,000 euro at age 25. Obviously, the exact amount is debatable. But the principle is that this wouldn't solve all inequality overnight, but it would ensure every person has some solid financial base.
So do what with?
To start a business, invest in education without crippling debt, put a down payment on a home. Basically, democratizing access to capital itself, which is usually highly concentrated. And then there's a third major piece, which is about expanding democratic participation within the economy. He calls it social ownership.
Social ownership. What does that entail? Not state ownership like in the old days.
No, not necessarily state ownership. It's more about fundamentally sharing power within corporations. The most concrete proposal here is requiring workers to have significant representation, maybe even half the seats and votes on corporate boards.
So workers get an equal say with shareholders.
Essentially, yes. Something like the German co-determination model, but perhaps even stronger. He sees this as vital to ensuring that capital serves a broader range of stakeholders, employees, communities, the environment, not just maximizing short-term returns for shareholders. It radically changes the legal definition of who a corporation is actually supposed to serve.
Right. So putting it all together.
That's the core synthesis, yeah. Participatory socialism, in his view, isn't about abolishing private property entirely like old school communism. It's about making property, especially large concentrations of it, subject to shared democratic control and rules. It's about breaking that sacred, absolute nature of ownership that defined the proprietarian era and led us back to high inequality.
Okay, so the key takeaway summary here feels incredibly powerful, and it really drives home the central message. The inequality we see today is fundamentally a political choice. It's not destined.
Yeah, absolutely not destined.
Then we have the historical proof that great compression period, that radical institutional change is possible. It can happen through collective political action, through new ideas, even when facing seemingly entrenched economic forces.
And if we connect that back to the really big picture, the whole massive book is underpinned by that core insight you mentioned earlier. Property is a social relation, not a natural right.
It's something we create as societies.
Exactly. And realizing that fundamentally shifts the entire debate. It moves us away from just arguing about income tax brackets, which is important, but limited towards thinking about the very organization of ownership itself, what things can be owned, under what conditions, and how must ownership be structured so that it serves the collective welfare, not just the owners.
That idea that property is a contingent legal creation feels like a really powerful final thought for you, our listeners, to carry forward. Piketty's sources clearly show that every new historical era tends to create new forms of property, new ways to concentrate wealth.
That's a great point.
So maybe you should consider this. As we move deeper and deeper into the digital age, what are the crucial non-physical assets today? Things like control over essential data, ownership of platform networks, complex intellectual property. Are today's elites using new ideological narratives to protect these forms of property? And could democratizing control over those assets become the next major battleground for equality? Something to think about.
Definitely something to think about.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into capital and ideology. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.